From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Whether or not Avatar wins at the Oscars this Sunday, the film's high-tech wizardry has already won praise and drawn record audiences. But no film has yet achieved the ultimate breakthrough, navigating the so-called uncanny valley that's digitally creating a realistic human character. WNYC's On the Media producer Jamie York explains why trying and missing the mark can lead to box office disaster.
In 2001, DreamWorks was paying approximately $60 million for an animated movie about a green ogre named Shrek. And the animation brain trust tasked with making this $60 million investment pay dividends was well on their way. Lovable if grotesque green ogre? Check. Donkey sidekick that cracks wise? Check. Fantastic world for everyone to inhabit? Check. There was just one problem.
Once upon a time, there was a lovely princess.
When they showed it to audiences of children, the children started crying and freaking out because there was something wrong.
That's Lawrence Weschler, who wrote about this incident for Wired magazine. It's true, the animators of Shrek were so good, so sophisticated, that they were scaring their intended audience. Why? The princess had fallen into what's known as the uncanny valley,
which was this notion by a Japanese roboticist named Masahiro Mori. The notion was that if you made a robot that was 50% lifelike, that was fantastic. If you made a robot that was 90% lifelike, that was fantastic. If you made it 95% lifelike, that was the best. That was so great. If you made it 96% lifelike, it was a disaster. And the reason essentially is because a 95% lifelike robot is a robot that's incredibly lifelike. A 96% lifelike robot is a human being with something wrong.
Mori called it the uncanny valley, a play on Sigmund Freud's idea of the uncanny, something familiar and yet foreign at the same time. The makers of Shrek, having learned their lesson, reimagined Princess Fiona as a slightly more cartoony-looking love interest, thus avoiding the valley. But Final Fantasy, a $135 million digital adventure, which opened the same year as Shrek, was fully animated with characters that were realistic in an unprecedented way, and yet not real enough. Audiences reported feeling unsettled, and the film bombed. The studio that made it later folded. On the other hand, Avatar.
Me and Norma here to drive these remotely controlled bodies called avatars, and they're grown from human DNA mixed with the DNA of the natives.
Avoids the uncanny valley because the aliens are distinctly alien, blue, stretched, and unreal. The faces of the Na'vi don't trigger our uncanny reflexes because they're simply not human. Faces. Despite 10 years of refinement in computer rendering, animators still can't accurately create them. So many muscles attached to each other moving in tandem. So many complex and inimitable plays of light.
With faces, and especially with the whites of eyes, light behaves in a quantum fashion, exactly the way it does in milk. So that if you want to create a digital glass of milk and have a digital light go around it, unless you use quantum physics, you're going to end up with something that looks like chalk.
And it's no coincidence that the digital movie company Pixar built its fortunes on protagonists that are easy to light. Shiny toys, cars, bugs, monsters, robots, and old men with square heads who love balloons.
Are you in need of any assistance today, sir?
No.
Well, I gotta help you cross something.
No, I'm doing fine.
But while it's clear that the uncanny valley alarms audiences and Pixar's made a mint by sidestepping the problem, the question remains, what makes us feel this way and why? Carl McDorman is a professor of computer-human interaction at the Indiana University Department of Informatics. Intent on understanding the valley, he's been testing precisely what we feel when we look at near humans on the screen.
Out of perhaps, 28 different emotions, there are about 5 key emotions that are highly predictive. And the most important one is fear. And anxiety, disgust, and shock. Fear stood out as being the most predictive of uncanny reaction.
There are a number of theories as to why we're afraid when we gaze at nearly real faces. One suggestion is that it's existential because we see the potential for being replaced by nearly perfect computers. Theologians argue that we're seeing human imitators that lack a soul. But the most convincing explanation for the fear may be evolutionary. We see in uncanny faces something unhealthy or unappealing, and our instinct is to recoil. Maybe they're contagious. Maybe they're not suitable mates. Asif Ghazanfar is a professor in the Neuroscience Institute in the Psychology Department at Princeton University. He'd heard of the dread engendered by the uncanny valley, so he sought to test the reaction with his evolutionary indicator of choice, macaque monkeys. Ghazanfar created for his subjects three different kinds of what he calls synthetic monkey faces. One unrealistic, one realistic, and one real. He flashed those faces on a screen for his five monkey subjects to watch in random order for 2 seconds each. And he tracked where their eyes went.
I mean, there's good reasons to think that they increase their looking times to things that they prefer. All five monkeys, as actually really remarkable, all five monkeys showed exactly the same pattern. When they look at the realistic, the one that we predict would elicit the uncanny valley response, they looked at those images the least amount of time, which is also seems consistent with the interpretation that we're actually seeing a real uncanny valley effect.
Ghazanfar's research seems to suggest that the valley is real and the response is evolutionary, but we still don't know why.
Sartre has this beautiful essay called The Face. He writes, "If I watch his eyes, I see that they are not fastened in his head, serene like agate marbles. They are being created at each moment by what they look at."
Lawrence Wechsler.
It's a great notion, the notion that what we face when we face a face is the future in some sense. It's omnivorous with intent and with expectation and with desire and with fear in a way that a thigh is not, which is why animating it becomes so much more complicated and so much more exciting.
Scientist Asif Ghazanfar of Princeton envisions the creation of a digital human face that could help treat autism, and Carl McDormand at Indiana University foresees a day when robots could alleviate loneliness in the elderly. But those real-world visions of what could be accomplished when we cross the uncanny valley and can build a foolproof human likeness will raise new existential questions that Hollywood simply can't prepare us for. McDormand fears the day an elderly woman realizes that her beloved companion that keeps her company is not real. That's an uncanny shudder of a different kind, the kind we have when we stare in the face of what it means to be human.
That was On the Media producer Jamie York. You can hear a longer version of Jamie's story when it airs this weekend on NPR's On the Media or go to onthemedia.org.
A feature film about a bomb disposal unit in Iraq, The Hurt Locker, is one of the favorites heading into Sunday's Academy Awards. It earned 9 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture. But the film has set off a debate within the military. As NPR's Tom Bowman reports, some say it's a sensationalized portrayal of the soldiers who disarm bombs.
25 meters.
Baghdad, 2004. A soldier in a heavy protective suit sets an explosive charge to destroy a bomb hidden in a pile of trash. Suddenly, his comrades spot a shopkeeper using a cell phone.
Butcher shop, 2 o'clock. Dude has a phone. Make him put it down.
Put down the phone.
Come on, guys. Talk to me.
Drop the phone.
Hey, burn him, Aldrin.
The cell phone sets off the bomb, killing the soldier trying to destroy it. That's the opening scene of The Hurt Locker, the one Jim O'Neill likes the best.
It kind of captured the whole environment over there in that first, 9 minutes.
O'Neill served as a Navy bomb disposal expert during the 1991 Persian Gulf War. He now runs a memorial foundation to those who died trying to disarm bombs.
I enjoyed the movie. There is some artistic license taken with some of the situations and processes. It's a movie. It's not a training film.
Not everyone liked it, though.
It's absolutely sensationalized.
That's Paul Rykoff. He served as an army officer in Baghdad, working with explosive ordnance disposal teams. The shorthand is EOD.
The idea that you'd put yourself in so much unnecessary danger is not only irresponsible, it's reckless, and that's really not what our EOD techs do.
The movie revolves around Staff Sergeant William James. He's the reckless one, an adrenaline junkie who joins the bomb disposal team.
How many bombs have you disarmed?
I'm not quite sure.
Sergeant.
Yes.
I asked you a question.
873.
873. 873.
The officer calls him a wild man. Sergeant James is a team leader, good at what he does, but not one to follow the rules.
What's he doing?
I don't know.
like taking off his body armor before dismantling a bomb.
What are you doing? There's enough banging there to send us all to Jesus. I'm gonna die. I'm gonna die comfortable.
Henry Engelhart liked the portrayal of Sergeant James. He remembers guys just like him from when he served as a bomb disposal expert in Vietnam.
Usually the ones that were fast and loose didn't last long.
Meaning they were killed?
They were either killed or were moved on to somewhere else.
Engelhart says in the movie, Sergeant James knows what he's doing, except for one scene, when he grabs a cable and pulls. Seven artillery shells come up out of the ground, all wired together, surrounding him. Sergeant James starts to cut the wires, one at a time. Not the right procedure, says Engelhart.
I was kind of like screaming at the screen, cut the main cable.
A small point, maybe. But Rykoff, the Iraq War veteran, worries that most Americans watching the film will get a distorted view of what soldiers face.
Very seldom is a guy going to put on a bomb suit and walk down there and try to dismantle something by hand. It just doesn't make sense. For the most part, they're going to use robotics. They're going to use other types of explosives to set off a control charge next to it. It's really a Hollywood sensationalized version of how EOD operates.
Sergeant James goes on to more adventures. The sergeant and his team become snipers in one scene. In another, he slips out of his base at night to lead a vigilante raid. That all reminds Rykoff of actor Matt Damon's rogue CIA character.
For example, goes outside the wire in civilian clothes and goes roaming around downtown Baghdad like Jason Bourne. I mean, that's just completely ridiculous.
Okay, so everyone agrees. The Hurt Locker's not a training film. Talk to soldiers who do this for real and you get two responses. Some will say they can't bear watching the movie. Others say the main character's based on them. And now one Army sergeant is so sure it is based on him that he's filed a lawsuit against the producers. He even says he came up with the term, the Hurt Locker. Tom Bowman, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Word is out again. The 1978 documentary, one of the first made by gay people about gay people, was a theatrical hit. It was also a landmark in the way it let its subjects tell their own stories at a time when those stories were, for the most part, not told. But finding the film has been difficult in the years since. Now it's back in theaters. Here's NPR's Netta Ulaby.
It was a wild slice of time. Post-Stonewall, pre-AIDS.
See the way he walks down the street. That's the way he shuffles his feet.
For some gay people, the 1970s meant vamping it up in white disco suits and really bad hair at the local gay community center. But Word Is Out paints with a broad brush. The film interviews 26 different gay Americans, from grandmas to drag queens, most careful not to speak for entire groups.
Even as a black lesbian, I wouldn't want to be seen as, this is how black lesbians are.
The collective of six gay men and lesbians who made Word Is Out interviewed a working-class Latina couple, early gay rights activist Harry Hay, an out-white corporate executive, and a bunch of flannel-shirted lesbians chopping down trees in the woods. The documentary presents one of the last moments in American history when the love that dared not speak its name mostly still didn't. The film's earnest, gentle tone actually irritated some gay activists.
I remember thinking, why isn't it sexier? And I remember thinking of it as spinach. I've changed my mind.
Jeff Weinstein is the former arts editor of The Village Voice. He remembers seeing Word Is Out when it was released in New York and a few other big cities in 1978.
It's only grown in its importance. I think that people have to see this to see how difficult it was, how brave people were.
I prayed a lot because I believed, well, if I have enough faith, I will get over this sickness or whatever.
One of the women who was interviewed was hospitalized by her parents.
The woman, identified only as Whitey in the film, was committed for almost all of her teenage years.
It was a horrible, horrible experience.
Whitey was in some ways lucky. Unlike another interviewee, she never endured shock treatments.
A little machine would be wheeled into the room from where it had just been being used in some other room on some other person. That would be the last thing that I would recall, would be just spinning wildly out of control.
How many were you given?
I really don't know. It would have been somewhere between 10 and 50.
Everyone interviewed in Word Is Out tells their stories quietly, in living rooms, offices, backyards. One very young man sitting in a sunny meadow says for the longest time he thought he was unable to feel emotion.
And when I fell in love with this guy, it was just, I mean, it meant so much to me. It meant I was a real person.
The young man was talking to an even younger filmmaker. Rob Epstein was still a teenager when he started working on the documentary.
It was my first movie, and it was my film school.
Epstein went on to make the acclaimed documentaries The Celluloid Closet and The Times of Harvey Milk. Epstein said Word Is Out informed everything he's done since.
Really, what it came down to was a discussion of very basic human emotions, feeling love for the first time, feeling self-actualized. You know, these are things that we all go through as human beings.
The young man Epstein was talking to in the film is now 57 years old. David Gillen lives in Connecticut, and he's still friends with the man who was his first love.
Being in the movie made me squirm. At the time, it was a phenomenon.
Gillen never expected Word Is Out to be anything bigger than a student project, and he was shocked when he started to get hundreds of letters from people telling him he'd given them hope of finding love, too. Gillen says he saw it as his duty to answer every single letter.
And I always say, if you're in the neighborhood, stop in. I didn't think that was going to happen, but it seemed like everybody I sent that kind of a letter to showed up at my door practically the next day.
Gillen says that's evidence of how isolated so many gay men and lesbians felt. The Word Is Out DVD is scheduled to come out in June, and it includes a follow-up about the film's subjects. About half of the men have died from HIV-related illness. One of the women is now straight. Two of them are still together.
We got 9 grandkids.
9 grandchildren.
And 2 great-grandchildren.
It might be hard for those great-grandchildren to conceive of how differently gay people lived in the 1970s. And for that, cultural critic Jeff Weinstein credits, in part, Word Is Out.
Other people were always defining who gay people were. This movie pushed people into understanding that gay filmmaking could be made.
That people could control how other people saw them by telling their own stories. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
It has been a really bad winter for potholes. If you've been scraping the underbelly of your car and getting madder and madder about it, maybe you can just point and click and zip. The problem will be fixed. A number of cities around the country now have systems where you can use your smartphone to document a problem, and the GPS coordinates will be sent straight to authorities. What they do from there, well, that's up to them. Ben Berkowitz is co-founder and CEO of C-Click Fix, an online tool that a number of cities are using. Ben, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And how did this get started for you?
I was trying to get graffiti off my neighbor's building, and after talking with him and realizing he wasn't going to help, I had a number of calls to City Hall, which went unanswered, and I wanted to create a public way of documenting these kind of non-emergency concerns.
So you were mad as hell and you weren't going to take it anymore.
I was pissed, and like a lot of good ideas, this one came from frustration.
And a website was born.
And a website was born, right. The first complaints were things like graffiti and potholes. And we started sending alerts about the issues to city government, and they started getting fixed very, very quickly. And we decided we should spread it.
Okay, I'm looking at a gallery of photos of various offenses on your website. A bunch of potholes, graffiti, garbage in backyard. Some of these right. are in French.
Yep. You know, we left the tool open to be anything that you wanted fixed in the public space in your community. And as you mentioned, some of those are in French. It has recently spread to parts of Argentina, Australia. You know, every community has different concerns, and we don't want to limit those communities from improving their space.
So say I see some grave offense, a humongous pothole,
yep.
and I take out my smartphone and I take a picture of it. Then what happens? I need to know where to send it?
The first thing you'd want to do is you'd want to download the C-Click Fix iPhone app or BlackBerry or Android app. You would open our application. And you would take a photo of the issue through the application.
Mm-hmm.
The application will show you where you are on a map. If you were in Tucson, you will, as an example of a city that's paying us and has put their service requests into the tool, you will select from something like pothole or graffiti, and you will hit report, and an email will be sent to Tucson. If you're in a city that's just receiving free email alerts from CClickFix, so we could say Hartford, Connecticut as an example, you take out the CClickFix app, you describe the issue, it could be anything, you report the issue with location, and an email will be sent to them as well.
You know, I'm looking at the CClickFix link for Tucson, and this little icon pops up. If something is fixed, it says fixed with an exclamation point, and there's a little arm holding a wrench. And I guess the city's reporting back, okay, we've taken care of this one.
Anybody can close an issue when it's resolved on CClickFix. Uh-huh. But, you know, responsive city employees tend to close it themselves once it's been fixed. But not everything gets fixed by a city employee. So, you know, anybody could pick up litter or shovel their neighbor's walk from snow. And so some of the things that get fixed are actually by citizens themselves.
What do you think, Ben? Is this making local government more responsive, or do you think it just makes the whole thing more transparent?
I think both. I think that it is accelerating the willingness to be publicly and transparently accountable at a local municipal level. I also think that there are some forces coming from our federal government that are encouraging this kind of transparent response as well. And so I think the pressure from citizens and the pressure from our federal leaders to be more open in our communication and encourage more participation at a civic level is really making this movement happen a lot quicker than I would have ever expected it to.
Ben Berkowitz, thanks for talking to us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Ben Berkowitz is the co-founder and CEO of CClickFix.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. On Sunday night, Academy Awards will be given for lots of categories, some obvious. We know what a supporting actor does or a screenwriter. But what does a sound mixer do? In a moment, we'll talk to a mixer who has won two Oscars himself. But first, a definition in two parts. On a movie set, the sound mixer records the actors and important ambient sound. Say they're shooting on a busy New York street corner. It's the sound mixer's job to make sure the cars driving by don't drown out the dialogue. Then a different mixer or team of mixers comes in at the very end of the process. After the film and its sound have been edited, the mixer blends the sound, making sure the explosions and music aren't too loud or the dialogue too soft. Russell Williams is a former sound mixer. He won Academy Awards for his work on the movies Glory and Dances with Wolves. Williams says that sound mixing, like everything else about the movies, is a subjective art.
I'm a person that believes in camera perspective. So if something is closer to the camera, it should sound closer. And as it gets further away, it should get further away. But some movies don't do that.
They want it all right up in
your
face.
They want it in your face and in your ear. So good examples would be, say, this year, something like Transformers or Star Trek. Since they're basically aimed at 12-year-old boys, the mixes are generally very loud, and they're mixed in what we would call a hyper-real type of state. In other words, everything is very present.
Well, you mentioned Transformers, for one, and let's take a listen to a clip from that movie right now.
Okay.
Kind of a symphony of sound effects going on there, Russell. What's going on in that
and
scene?
In this scene, you have something like a mechanical robot tiger that drops what looks like 1,000 ball bearings down a pipe. And then these ball bearings end up on a hard cement floor, and they start rolling. But then they turn into these other very tiny mechanical robots or spiders, and they go off looking for trouble.
You mentioned how you're a fan of camera perspective matching sound.
Yes.
And let's take a listen now to a clip from the movie The Hurt Locker, also
okay.
Nominated for sound mixing.
Very different movie.
How long are you guys out here?
Oh, I don't know. Specials? What do we got?
We have 23 more days.
Oh, God.
We have 22 days after today.
Well, no one's counting.
Hey, this job never finishes.
If you want to compare the two, say, Transformers to Hurt Locker is more like a singer that's singing a cappella.
Hmm.
Transformers is a singer that's singing in front of the Basie band or a big rock band. You've got a lot of energy going on. So there's a lot more subtlety there. In Hurt Locker, you hear the wind. The scene was several military men out in the desert, and they think that they're safe and by themselves. And then all of a sudden, one of the gentlemen is hit by a rifle round. And the thing that I liked about how this was mixed is that rifle rounds travel faster than sound. So he was hit and on the ground before the sound of the rifle actually got to the people. Then the rest of the men go into action and they pull their weapons out and they try to find the snipers. But for many years, the Hollywood convention was to sell you this lie, actually, that if you saw a gun, you heard the gun. And that's only true at close distances. The further away you get, there's a delay between the sound and the actual shot of the gun.
So it helps to know some physics if you're going to be a sound mixer.
Right, it does. And, of course, it's ultimately the director's choice. If the director wants to ignore the rules of physics, it's fine if it keeps the story from breaking up and falling apart. Outer space movies are known for this. In other words, 2001, Space Odyssey, you heard no sound in the vacuum of space. The Star Wars movies, you always hear sound in the vacuum of space. Now, does that ruin the movie for you? It's up to you. In Star Trek, one of the nominees for this year, they actually straddle the fence. There's portions of it where you don't hear sound in the vacuum and portions where you do. It's really a creative choice.
We've talked about three of the nominees for sound mixing. Another nominee in this category is Avatar.
Yes.
As in most of the other categories this year. What do you think about the mixing on Avatar?
I thought Avatar was very skillfully done. Just from reading about some of the work they did, it was an 80-day final mix. But looking at the fact that it took them years to do all the special effects and shoot the film, it doesn't surprise me, but there's a lot of subtlety in Avatar. There are very big scenes and big battles, but because you go to a world that none of us have actually been to, it really gives the sound designers, the editors, and all of their teams an opportunity to create something unique. And it sounds kind of like movies we've heard that were supposed to be in the jungle, like the Amazon, but then there's some elements that we haven't heard before because no one's been to Pandora.
Right. You can imagine what they're like. What about Inglourious Basterds and the director Quentin Tarantino here, how he's using sound and imagining this sound landscape?
Papa? Quentin Tarantino is very creative. Not only does he use music as a separate character, in my opinion, he uses a lot of Morricone and other sound cues that kind of make you feel it's a Western.
You're talking about Ennio Morricone from
right,
the Spaghetti Westerns.
Right. One of my favorites of his was Once Upon a Time in the West. But Tarantino skillfully overlays that sound, but with a World War II movie. One of the other key elements in the film is that language is very important. I mean, you hear German quite a bit in the film. You hear French quite a bit. You hear a little bit of Italian. And, of course, we hear English. So they pay close attention to how each voice of each character is recorded. And there's a nice scene in the cafe where one of the undercover military men is found out. So he switches from German.
Was jetzt passieren wird, Sturm. Bannführer.
To English, and then the scene just collapses in a big gunfight.
About this pickle we find ourselves in. It would appear there's only one thing left you to do.
And what would that be?
Stiglitz.
See how feeders into your Nazi boss.
Just from listening to it, I believe that a lot of the production dialogue, meaning the sound that was recorded on location, survived. Where a lot of films, say, I'm just guessing, but say Star Trek, even though a lot of it was done on set, there are a lot of things that create the visuals that you see that ruin the production track. So in a lot of cases, those films end up using the production sound as what we call a guide track, so they can be re-recorded later. But that's not always the case, mm-hmm. but just something you're listeners should be aware of.
Doing it after the fact.
Absolutely.
In post-production. Russell Williams, enjoy the Oscars on Sunday.
Will do. Thank you for the invite.
Russell Williams is a former sound mixer, now an artist in residence at American University's School of Communications. He won Oscars for mixing Dances with Wolves and Glory. Thank you. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Blanc.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Last week, we told you how the city of Tracy in California's Central Valley is starting to charge when its fire department responds to medical emergencies. Officials say the city needs the extra revenue to balance its budget during the recession. Well, it turns out this practice isn't unique to Tracy or even California. As Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler reports from Sacramento, it's raising questions about whether it's a good policy and who really gets stuck with the bill.
When you hear this sound coming from a fire engine these days, chances are it's not heading towards a burning building. It's responding to a medical emergency. Like this response a few days ago. A patient needed to get to a hospital, 911 was called, and 5 minutes later, firefighters were on the scene. The patient was a man probably in his 60s, apparently suffering from chest pains, but he was conscious and alert. As the crew wheeled him down the hall on a stretcher, he looked up and said, "Call me a cab, it's cheaper." Fact is, it's pretty darn expensive to get a ride to the hospital, in some cases more than $1,000. Now, here's where the whole Tracy situation comes in. There's a general consensus that in most cases, the firefighters tend to arrive first. That means they're the first ones to treat the patient. Sacramento area fire captain Roy Cameron says that treatment has become far more sophisticated over his 30 years on the job.
When I started, we're doing CPR on people. We had no drugs to push onto them, no monitors. It was all just everything by hand. It's gotten a lot better. A lot more life-saving techniques make a big difference.
What used to be called basic life support is now advanced life support, or ALS. Cameron says the number of calls have gone up, and so has the cost.
But to me, if it's going to save a life, it's worth $1 million. I mean, you can't put a price on it.
But some fire departments do exactly that. They charge several hundred dollars for treating medical emergencies.
Typically, what these types of programs are doing is simply recovering the cost of augmenting the service to the community.
John Sinclair is the chief of a fire department in Ellensburg, Washington, and the go-to expert on emergency medical services for the International Association of Fire Chiefs. He says it's easy to forget that ALS is part of the healthcare system, just like an ambulance ride. Fire departments have to pay for it somehow.
As local communities' public safety budgets are being squeezed, I believe we're going to see more and more systems that historically may have done it for free that can no longer do it for free.
And faced with a choice between dropping ALS or charging a fee, well, Sinclair's pretty sure Tracy won't be the last city to start hunting for cash. But while health insurance almost always covers ambulance rides, it doesn't always pick up ALS fees. For example, California's Medicaid program doesn't cover them at all. Georgia insurance agent Russ Childers, who heads the National Association of Health Underwriters, says companies will have to respond somehow if more fire departments start charging.
If this is a trend that adds cost to the system, then premiums would have to be adjusted to reflect those costs. It wouldn't have a tremendous effect on premiums, but it has the possibility of having that effect.
Or, Childers says, insurers could choose to not cover ALS fees at all. Jamie Court with the group Consumer Watchdog says that might make patients think twice before calling 911.
If you need advanced life support, you shouldn't be worrying about whether to make a call that's going to cost you hundreds of dollars. You should just make that call.
There aren't any hard figures on how many fire departments are charging this fee across the country. What we do know is emergency medical systems vary widely. And as one firefighter puts it, when you've seen one EMS system, well, you've seen one EMS system. For NPR News, I'm Ben Adler in Sacramento.